You are tuned into Business Sense on Adventist World Radio, powered by SID Media.
It is, of course, a Monday. That means it is Personal Finance Monday right here on the show. And my guest this evening is, of course, Uvangile Makwakwa, the founder of Wealthy Money. I already love this thing, right? Already from the age of Wealthy Money. Yeah, it means we're going the right direction. She is passionate about helping people heal. That's the most operative word for me there. She's passionate about helping people heal their money trauma so they can unlock their inner money guru and thrive. And one of the ways is through her book, which is called What's Your Money Personality? Changing the Way Black Families Manage Their Finances. And she's joining us on the line. Good evening, ma'am.
Good evening, Tapela. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for asking. And yourself?
I'm fine, thank you.
How was your holiday?
Very great. I've enjoyed it thoroughly.
Okay. Pray tell.
Well, I live in the Cape, so yeah. It's been, actually, Cape Town has been uncharacteristically warm.
Okay.
Today it took a turn to get colder, but the last Saturday and Sunday was so warm.
Yeah.
It really felt like summer.
Yeah.
So it was a lot of fun.
Okay. So it was an opportunity to go out there and just explore it a bit. I must be honest with you, because that's my favorite place.
It is my favorite city too.
Really?
So to
look at
my
that.
Favorite city is just such a blessing.
Look
it's
at that.
Beautiful.
It's a beautiful
the sunset,
place.
The ocean. Yeah. The fact that like everyone is so slow.
Mm.
Other cities, people have, like, everything has to move fast.
Yeah.
In Cape Town, things just slow. I mean, the downside is if you're in business, things take longer in Cape Town.
Yeah.
But I'm like, it's worth it.
Yeah. I love it. I love Cape Town. So anyone that's from Cape Town knows that, look, I envy them in a goodly way, right? I envy people that stay in Cape Town, because that's my favorite country. So you and I should trade places one of these days, eh?
Yeah.
But thank you so much, ma'am, for joining us this evening. We really, really appreciate your time, taking time off your holiday. But we really, really appreciate it. And I think we're talking about a very, very important topic here, which is, of course, our money personalities. But I want to start with your book. Sure, I have utmost respect for authors, because I do think that it takes time, it takes energy. I know a few people who have started and be like, yo, I just gave up on this thing on the way. For you to actually write and finish a book, I have absolute respect for authors, because it takes a lot. What was your journey like?
Well, this is my second book, really third,
okay.
If you count my journals.
Okay.
So, yeah, the first one is called Heart, Mind and Money, and it did quite well. But, like, this one is longer.
Okay.
It's more in-depth. Heart, Mind, and Money had as much research.
Yeah.
But I think everyone feels like this one, the research is weightier. It's
okay.
Not this one. The research went in-depth into so many different places. So it was hard. Some days I would just cry.
Yeah,
but
I'm sure.
I think. The thing that helped me was that I had, like, being published by Penn Macmillan, and then having, like, your editor, your publisher, all the different people behind you. It makes such a huge difference, because you don't really have an option to give up, because you've already signed your contract.
Yes, so. And you must deliver on that contract.
Exactly. But it's nice, because, you know, like, I think when you're a writer, I always say, like, writing, unlike most other art disciplines, it's like, it's so, people never really get to see publicly. Like, if you're a sculptor or you're a painter, people can see the progress. As a writer, people have to take your word for it.
Mm.
And so having people that can read your writing and then feedback on it, it's helpful.
Yeah.
It doesn't always feel helpful at the time, because you're like, what? Now I have to go back to the beginning of the book when I'm still reading, I'm still writing the middle part of the book, but it is so worth it.
Ah,
it's
fantastic.
Really fun.
Fantastic. And what would be one or two key lessons that you want people to take out of this particular one book?
The two key lessons. The first one is that money really is not an individual effort, which I put right in the book, that wealth and wealth creation, contrary to popular belief and what we've been taught, it is not something that happens in a vacuum and is not just an individual effort.
Yeah.
I mean, here I look more at like, Black wealth and Black wealth creation. But even if you look at people like your Bill Gates, Bill Gates and some of the other big people, they've had support bases and they had people behind them that supported them. So that's key. And then the second one is to say, I want people to walk away with an understanding that if you come from a background with trauma, where there's a lot of trauma, be it racial trauma, gender inequality, or just family dynamics that lead to deep trauma. You carry that in your body, and that affects the way that you make financial decisions, as opposed to someone who comes from a great background, has never experienced deep racial wounds, has never experienced deep gender wounds, has always had great support, has had maybe an upper middle class or middle class upbringing. Their relationship with money is completely different. And that basically puts them at a different level to you when you have never had any financial literacy or have only known worries and anxiety around money.
Often the topic of money is a taboo one amongst our community, right? Because of, like you said, anxiety, past experiences with it. And even those that, you know, often get the opportunity to actually have a little bit of it also because of maybe not having dealt with their own childhood traumas around money. We see them on iBlueIt, isn't it?
Exactly. And that's a big, big thing. So I think that so many of us don't realize how our upbringing has impacted us and on a financial level, right? And it's not even just the upbringing within the family. In the book, I talk about just how like research shows that if you've been experiencing microaggressions your whole life, just in terms of racism, that there's actual proof that shows that shortens your lifespan. It actually impacts your body, the physics of your body, you know? So now you no longer worry just about your mental health. It's also your physical health at stake. And there's research that also shows, in the book I mentioned this, that poverty has been like growing up in poverty. They have found that children's brains, the gray matter in children's brains is different. So children that have grown up in poverty or with extreme situations of lack, the gray matter in their brains is underdeveloped compared to gray matter in someone who has never experienced what it's like to not have. And to just not have experienced poverty or not knowing how you're going to get to school. That literally impacts you. That means that the way, like your brain is already incapacitated in the way that you make decisions. And research also shows that your decision-making faculties are impacted based on your relationship with money and how much poverty you have experienced. So if you've grown up in situations where there was never enough money, the way that your brain processes decision-making when money is concerned is completely different to someone who has grown up having money and knowing that the bills are going to be paid. You are more likely to make short-term decisions around money always versus long-term decisions.
That's interesting. Okay, then let's talk about money personalities. Interesting topic. Just to break it down a little bit, what are we talking about? No one, and maybe quite a lot of our listeners as well, never thought of, there's a thing about money and personality in there.
Yes. So in the book, I share how, for me, one of the things that I've seen in my work is that when someone has gone through, because all of us, because of whatever ancestral trauma we carry, it has shaped the way our families function.
Yeah.
So if you reflect on just your family dynamics when it comes to, you'll notice that they were heavily shaped by money, right?
Yeah.
How much money a person earns, like you would move to different neighborhoods if your parents earned more, etc. So that would also start to shape your personality in the family around money. We all respond to trauma differently.
Yeah.
And based on how we respond to trauma, that then shapes our money personalities.
Yeah.
And that and our money's personalities then shape how we make money, spend money, save money, and invest money.
Okay. And why then is it important for one to know their own money personality?
Because most of the time we are just, we don't, what we've been taught is that financial literacy is the key, right? Not against financial literacy. But then we don't understand why is it that two people can we, let's say I have a best friend.
Yeah.
Both of us go to a financial literacy class.
Yeah.
My best friend walks out thriving for that, from that class.
Yeah.
She gets everything. I try to implement what has been taught and I fail at it.
Yeah.
That's because what financial literacy is not taking into account is that not we may both be in debt, but we are not getting into debt for the same reasons.
Yes.
So once you understand your money personality, you start to understand the root cause of your financial of your financial behavior.
Yeah.
So just because the symptoms are similar does not mean that the cause is the same.
Okay. So it starts by understanding what's the root cause of it.
And that's why for most of us, for example, I talk in the book about the money archetype, who is the fixer or the sweet one.
Yeah.
So the fixer and the sweet one, when they go to financial literacy classes, and I'm neither of those personalities, right?
Yeah.
They literally can walk out of there and implement whatever they have learned.
Yeah.
The rest of us, if you're a destroyer, a runaway, or an eternal child, good luck to you.
Sure.
Those money personalities are highly unlikely to really thrive. And even with the sweet one, they won't get as much from the way financial literacy works as the fixer.
Yeah.
The way that our entire system is set up is that it literally tends to serve these two money archetypes, but it actually serves the fixer more than anyone else because they are more logical when it comes to money. For them, when you are teaching budgeting, I studied finance, but like, and I knew budgeting theoretically, but to apply it to my own life, impossible.
Yeah.
I could never have less than an overdraft in my bank account ever. You know, I was always in overdraft and I knew all the theories and all the financial literacy. But that's because like my money trauma and the root cause of my money trauma wasn't being addressed.
Yeah.
What constantly happens whenever we're taught financial literacy is that people do not know the practical aspects of money. And I've always said, that is a lie because it is the same as we say people don't know how what they need to do to lose weight. Well, most of us already know you need to eat your fruit, vegetables, drink lots of water, walk, and not have junk food. The only difference is why don't we all do it, right? That is the gap that we need to figure out, is that why is it that even when we have the practical information, why are we unable to then implement it? Each of the money profiles has a reason that stops them from implementing. And that's their core wounds that I explore in the book, which is to say, once you can understand your money profile, you can understand your core wounds, and then you can start to understand why you're not able to implement the practical stuff around money.
Yeah.
Once I was able to understand that, and that's what I work with my clients, once they're able to understand that as well, then it just becomes easier to shift things on a very practical level.
Yeah.
Paying off debt becomes easier.
Yeah.
Saving becomes easier. Making money becomes easier.
Yeah.
But it will not be easy for all of us because the way that the system is set up and the way that we are all taught doesn't really take into account our trauma and our core wounds.
Sure. There's a saying that inyanga ayizelaphi, right, which is loosely translated that a doctor wouldn't necessarily heal themselves. In other words, they know how to heal other people. They know how to diagnose other people, but often struggle with diagnosing themselves, right? And I think you also find the same thing with people around finances, that it's usually the ones who are in the industry, the ones who went to school and studied to become something with finance in it, that often struggle with their finances. They might even be CFOs for big companies, and but when it comes to their own finances, it can be a little bit different there. What's your view on that thought?
Well, I say you're talking to me,
right? Okay,
I mean,
right.
I went to study finance, and then I did my business science honors degree at UCT in finance.
Mm.
Then I went to do an MBA in finance, and I could not understand money for anything. I could do it for other people, but I couldn't do it for myself.
Yeah.
That's why I had to go on a whole journey to learn what is this healing and how do I heal myself and try to understand that. But yeah, I find that to truly be the case. And I am a prime example of that. I keep telling people that just because a person studied something, it doesn't mean that you understand it for yourself.
Yeah.
You may actually be worse off. I could always help others and explain. If when people would come to me, I would be able to explain investments.
Yeah.
I was that kid that was seen as smart, but I was dying in shame internally because of the state of my own finances.
Yeah. And there's this often unsaid, but it's almost like an expectation, right? Especially if you work in finance, personal finance, particularly in this particular discussion that we're having, right? Because, you know, you and I know there's corporate finance, there's all those sort of stuff. But when you think about personal finance, there's an unsaid expectation that when you speak about it, then you would live it, right? And so people judge you based on how you look when you're standing there in front and talking about money. People judge you based on the car you drive or don't drive. But people are like, there's no way we'll listen to this guy who is also getting into the same taxi with us and telling us about finances. How have you dealt with that? I want to get into that before we just round it up with the different personalities there.
I think that's such a powerful question. I always share a story about how I was once almost denied entrance into a speaking engagement where I was a speaker to talk about money because I used to drive my black Corsa.
Yeah.
So like, and I'm a nomad. And I was at this point, I must have moved back from Sri Lanka for like the millionth time.
Yeah.
And then just was, I went to pick up some clothes at my mom's place in the village, stopped over in Joburg and was driving down to Cape Town.
Yeah.
And people wouldn't let me in. And the organizer had to come through and be like, okay, no, this is just who she is. Like, she's not homeless. She's not living out of a car.
Yeah.
But a lot of that is just perception. And I think a huge part of it is the work isn't for other people to do. It's for us.
Yeah.
Understanding your financial vision, understanding what it is that why you are choosing to live the way that you're living. At the time for me, it would have made zero sense because most of the time I was spending 3 months in South Africa and 9 months abroad to have an expensive car. Why would I want to have an expensive car? And when I'm away, I actually pay insurance on my car.
Yeah.
And most of the time I would always have to come home and replace the battery because no one would be driving my car for 9 months.
Yep.
Couldn't get anyone in my family to start my car regularly. They have their own lives, right?
Yes, yes.
So I think that's a huge thing. It's we need to look within and not worry so much about what it is that they're going to say. And then when you stand in your truth, address that. Because I know that people are scared. What are my clients going to say?
Yes.
I have openly spoken about this with my clients, you know, and it was just a running joke. You know, this is the car I drive and this is why, this is the lifestyle I choose. But at the same time, I haven't, still true, I haven't had debt since 2014. I don't, at the end of the month, have to worry about paying someone. You know, I own my properties outright. I don't have to stress about, I don't have to stress about who am I owing. Everything that I'm paying that is a debit order is for my investments. It's towards my savings. It's towards my investments. So why is it that you're doing what you're doing? Because that will give you courage, you know, to just do whatever and allow people to talk. And a huge part of why we are in debt, if we are truly honest, a lot of us, it's so that we get approval from other people. Because you, how can you be a chartered accountant driving an old beat up car? Living in a way where you're just buying clothes from just any place as opposed to the top places. Are you sure you have money? Are you sure you know what you're talking about?
And I think it's just a trauma response from people, right? And maybe we as speakers as well, we are also just showing our trauma by responding to that trauma as well. Because I find that for me, and I could be wrong, but I find that if you are going to judge me based on the car that I drive to a speaking arrangement, you've got trauma with me. And if I respond to you, I'm also just, you know, kind of also showing my own trauma with it. And we need to find some sort of way to deal with it. I think now you've mentioned a few of those personalities, but very briefly, can you just outline them for us as we draw to a close?
Yes. So the first personality profile that I'll mention is the fixer. So the fixer is the main breadwinner in the family. The reason why fixers are born into a family is they are literally born to propel the family forward financially. So their main focus will be finances. Part of why they inflict trauma on the family, though, is that they are overly focused on finances to the detriment sometimes of people's sole purpose and who they are as people and not being able to fully understand how family dynamics operate outside of money. So they tend to be controlling and can sometimes even derail people from, say, their sole purpose because they don't understand it. But they will usually step in to pay for things. They will literally, they can move a family from literally maybe just a shack community to the upper echelons of society. We're talking going global, building global companies. So they don't make up a huge portion of the population. Right? And they tend not to be liked by the family.
Do they have like a big brother syndrome thing?
Yes, they do.
Yeah, yeah.
They do. But they're very, very challenging to get along with in a family.
Sure.
Not to be confused with a sweet one, because a lot of sweet ones tend to think that they are fixers. And the first thing that I say to them, because they also breadwinners, but a sweet one will tend to get into debt. Fixers get into debt, but not for long. They know how to make money. And if they're in debt, it is for a reason. And they can get out of it. Sweet ones will often drown in debt because of the demands of the family. They won't get into debt for their own reasons. It's it's often for other people more than anything. They struggle with boundaries and the family loves the sweet one. So often what I have seen in families, and I've since had time to speak to many people that when they've read the book where they've said, the family has turned on a fixer, but then they elected a sweet one to lead the family, thinking that they are the same and they because they both breadwinners. A fixer can handle the demands of a family. A sweet one will often buckle under. and without the bound, without a fixer that has not healed and become the boundaried one, can let anything just happen. Mm. Oh, you don't have a job, I'll support you.
Okay.
Oh, you're fighting with so-and-so, it's fine, just come through, I'll support you, because they're the glue of the family.
Yes.
Whereas fixers don't play that game.
Okay.
Right? Their money comes with a lot of talk.
Yeah.
A lot of issues and anger and resentment.
Mm.
A sweet one gives and is generous naturally. Mm. So just the reason why I mention this and I stress these two is because I have seen the impact of this in my own family.
Yeah.
And I've heard so many people share as well what has happened when a family has turned on a fixer to make the sweet one the financial head.
Mm.
And the impacts of that, the ramifications are hectic.
Mm.
And then you've got the destroyer. The destroyer archetype is more like the black sheep of the family.
Okay.
They tend not to get along with the family a lot. They tend to mirror a lot of what is wrong with the family.
Okay.
So when things are going crazy within the family, they are the ones that will tell you. So they're very uncomfortable to be around. So think of the aunts or uncles or parents even that you invite, and they will remind everyone, cousin so-and-so took money from so-and-so. They haven't paid them back. Please don't get on my case, you know? So they're very vocal and can be extremely violent in their words, you know, and which can cause strain. But the reason why they do that is they are trying to fix things, but by first showing what is wrong.
Mm.
They want the things that are wrong to be sorted and fixed.
Mm.
And that can sometimes cause a lot of challenges.
Mm.
Destroyers are important to a family because they unearth all the trauma that we try to bury.
Okay.
Where the sweet one, where the sweet one and the fixer will just build over what is wrong.
Sure.
The destroyer says, can we please fix this, take it apart, and then rebuild. But the way they haven't learned how to do that. So their trauma response is to just go straight into fight mode.
Yeah.
So like, people will always be like, Abana peace.
Yeah. You know, they no wait peace. For family meetings and weddings and stuff like that. And then they come out with these things there, right? During the people.
And they love that shame. They love it.
Oh my. Oh
and so
my.
So people, and I speak as a destroyer, by the way.
Oh, my goodness.
So people will often say that they just don't have peace. A destroyer, once they heal, becomes the way that they make a lot of their money is truly through innovation, because they are here. If you think of destroyers as your activists, as the people that are like constantly pointing out what is wrong in society and fighting it, when they start to heal and go into their renovator stage, they completely can transform not just the family, but society.
Nice.
They are the ones that give us new innovations, new ways of doing things, new ways of looking at things. But as long as they stay in the destroyer state, it's the opposite that happens. They have the capability to really destroy and break families apart.
Mm.
Then you've got the runaway.
Mm.
We all know the runaway. The runaway is that aunt or uncle or mom or dad that only shows up to family gatherings if it's necessary. You'll see them at a funeral or a wedding.
Oh, no.
And even at a birthday, very rare.
Mm.
They're not about to be part and parcel of the family trauma. Part of it is that they are born into a family to basically help a family metabolize trauma.
Okay.
But what often happens is that our traumas are so overwhelming as families that it overwhelms them, and then they need to escape their bodies.
Run away.
And so unconsciously, they end up escaping the family as well.
Mm.
So they just disappear. And if they don't have an outlet to actually physically leave the family, they will disappear through drugs and alcohol because they need to escape the trauma. So their core work is to really get back into their bodies and learn to also figure out how do they metabolize trauma for themselves.
Mm.
So as the destroyer unearths the trauma, the runaway is supposed to help the family then take it in, basically metabolize it. Unfortunately, they do it physically. So a lot of your work happens to be in the body as well.
Yeah.
Right?
Sure.
So once they start to understand that, a lot of runaways are always shocked. Why do they end up, when they have to heal, they'll end up doing things like yoga, fitness, gym, all those things. A lot of it is because a lot of the stuff, their work has always been in the body because they're taking in so much from the family. And so the challenge with them, though, is because their core trauma response is flight, flight mode.
Yeah.
So when they encounter anything financially that feels uncomfortable, they run.
They run.
They will change jobs. They can change jobs like 4 or 5 times in a year.
Mm.
They will change careers. So they have a hard time staying put when things get hard, which makes it hard for them to build wealth in the long term. They will run away. If debt starts to pile up, they'll just ignore the debt.
Oh, man.
Those are the ones that go over like, oh, credit card bill came in. Ugh, no, you only live once.
Yo.
Let's go party.
YOLO.
You know? Exactly. So they're very good at that. And that's also just a trauma response, right?
Sure.
Then you've got the eternal child. The eternal child learned to deal with trauma by freezing. They were born. Their role within the family is to just show us where we all got stuck in our childhood and teen trauma. So this can be someone who is in their 60s, but you come home and they're still living at home, still living in their old room, still having their parents cook for them, or everyone else in the family is paying for them. Like, you borrow them your car, it will come back on empty. They just don't seem to have grown up. And it doesn't matter. Even if they have like a lot of degrees, they may struggle to hold on to work, get a job. If they do have a job, they may struggle with actually handling their finances. So they may get paid lots of money, but just rent however they want to rent, drive whatever car they want to drive. Then someone else in the family will often step in to look after them, mother them. Often their parents. Their parents will look after them regardless. When they have kids, those kids will be looked after. Siblings will have to step in. It causes a lot of challenges within the family. So the eternal child, out of all the archetypes, is one of the most challenging archetypes because of the journey that they have to go through to heal. It's like, because you're working with children. So I always say to people, because I have so many people that come to me, oh my God, I have an eternal child in my hands, my child, my siblings, whatever. And I always say, or even parents are sometimes eternal children. And that I always say, remember, this person has grown up. They look like they are 40. But when it comes to their finances, a four-year-old is running the show. And four-year-olds do not know anything about mortgages. This is why when they get paid, regardless of how much they get paid, the first thing that they'll sometimes go buy is lovely food, clothing, toys, all those things, you know, like cars, all those things, because that's what children do. When children have money, they go and they buy toys, they buy good food, they go buy pretty clothes, all those things. They go on vacation, all that. So that's the challenge with the eternal child.
So the eternal child doesn't matter what age they're in.
No.
That's an interesting one. Sure. So can you get a hybrid, a little bit of, I suppose, the fake side, a little bit of the sweet one, you know, destroying here, just here and there, just destroying once in a while. But you also, you know, you become the runaway and you come back and you become a child. Can you get a hybrid of sort?
Yes, you tend to have like, because there's the 10 archetypes in essence.
Okay.
So I've just shared the shadow archetypes. And with some of them, I've shared the golden archetypes, like how the destroyer becomes the renovator. Right? You can be two primary shadow archetypes, and then your shadow archetypes will be the opposites, will then be the golden archetypes. But you will tend to be predominantly one or the other. You tend to run from one or the other. You may exhibit characteristics of the other archetypes, but when I sit down with people and we really look at what their archetypes are, they're like, no, I see this is my predominant and this is my secondary archetype. So, for example, my predominant archetype is the destroyer, and my secondary archetype is the runaway. So when I can't destroy, I will inevitably, without a doubt, run away.
Sure.
And that is something that I have noticed over time within me. So if it just, I'll just completely do a full runaway act. And for me, I will physically run away. You know, like I will leave countries and just be gone.
Someone's saying, I'm learning a lot from this topic. This is powerful. This is Zezo Didi. Trauma response in life in general is really killing us. And yeah, this topic is really, really deep. And yeah, thank you so much to you, you know, Vangile, for unearthing our traumas and all those sort of stuff that we are not aware of. I'm sitting here and I'm like, Anzuchonics, I'm not going to tell people because I can see mine there. Because the next thing, I'll be getting WhatsApp messages. So I'm going to hold it right there. Hold the bus. But I can definitely identify one of them here. And it'll be interesting to see, you know, the other one. If I don't do this, this is what I do. You know, so interesting to do that. So how do we, as we close, how do we go about identifying then which one I fall under?
Oh, I share that in the book. This is a good reason to get the book. So in the book, there are worksheets, there are questions. There's also an entire chapter that shows you how you interact with each of the archetypes. And it always shocks me how, like, I've had people go, I'm a fixer, I get along very well with the sweet one. And I go, read the book. You'll understand that, that is literally, there's a reason for that. It's a match made in heaven in that case. There's questions, and under each chapter and each archetype, you also get questions to understand that archetype better and how you can approach them, how you can work with them and interact with them. It's something I myself had to learn, right? When I realized that, shucks, I'm a destroyer, you know? There's a reason why people don't always want to be around me in the family, so how do I fix this and course correct?
That's an interesting one. And so someone asking, how do I get the book? And that would be, of course, my question as well.
Okay. So the book is available at all exclusive bookstores, Woodsworth. It's also available at Bargain Books. It's available on Amazon and on Take A Lot as well. So definitely try Take A Lot. If your exclusive books is sold out, because some of them are really sold out already, then definitely go to Take A Lot or just tell exclusive books to order more copies.
Ah, fantastic. It's been a beautiful conversation. How do we sum it up, bring it home?
I'm not really sure. I guess just to say to people, thank you. And I feel like one of the things that I can't stress enough again is that most of the time, a huge part of why we are struggling to build generational wealth is because of our traumas. And in my book, I actually interview my dad on chapter 18. Sure. His family dynamics are so different from my mom's family dynamics, as in, like, their family did not have half the intense trauma that my mom's family had. And as a result, they were able to completely change the dynamics around Black tax so that my generation, my cousins and I have never had to experience that from my paternal side. So really understanding that. So I really just want to say I recommend this book because I look at both sides and I really interrogate even just my own story. And I also have case studies where each of the archetypes share their own case studies. And I have someone, my clients, sharing their journey and how they healed. And that tends to help other people heal.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much, ma'am. Really appreciate your insights. And definitely the book is a must-have. May God bless you in your journey and the work that you do. It's very, very important. And I hope it continues to change people's lives. Thank you so much, ma'am.
Thank you. Have a lovely evening.
Have a good one. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You are tuned into Business Sense on Adventist World Radio, powered by SID Media.